What's going on, everybody? Patrick Bear here, and we are back again. It is now the month of October. It is rapidly approaching the end of the year. Where has the year 2023 gone?
Into the toilet.
Yes, in many, many ways has it done that, but we are back for our roundtable discussion of all things pop culture. I am joined by the voice you heard before, Brian.
Hello.
I'm also joined by BJ.
Hey, what's up?
And Eric.
Hello.
Hello, everybody. We are back. We have convened. There's been a lot of travel. All of us, actually, I believe, were gone in the past couple of weeks for different adventures. Some more fun than others, I think, overall. But Brian, you were halfway across the world in Japan.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to do a quick thing, but no. Tell us, how was the trip to Japan? I mean, aside from, you know, not feeling well after getting back.
Yeah. So I was just talking before we started about my illness that I have had since I got back. But the best part to Japan was going to see a volcano in Kyushu. There is an active, one of the, I think, most active volcanoes in Japan, Sakurajima, which is the whole island. Forgot the actual name of the volcano. But either way, it was really cool. Very worth going all the way down to Kagoshima, which is a beautiful city as well in southern Kyushu. But yeah, Japan was great. Food's always amazing until it decides it wants to infect your gut and give you some kind of gastroenteritis, which is what I got. So yay, food poisoning. The good news, or it's not good news. The news is what I got. Sorry, I was thinking the song. Is not abnormal. You can get this called Campylobacter. You can get this bacteria anywhere in the world. It is a very common bacteria caused by underprepared poultry. And unfortunately, you have no way to know it is underprepared because you may not even get it from the chicken. You may get it because they cut up chicken, kind of like the whole salmonella. You know, we're always worried about salmonella poisoning. I will tell you right now, this is worse. So if you ever decide, if you ever get this, I'm sorry. And, overall, Japan was fine. I'm definitely glad to be back in the States and not sick.
Nice. BJ, you did a quick jaunt back to Orlando and over to Palm Springs. How were those trips?
Oh, it was. So the Orlando one was just kind of a surprise trip for World Bear Expo. That was in Orlando, Florida. And I surprised a bunch of people because a lot of people were like, are you going? And I was like, no, I'll be in Puerto Rico. And then those deployments ended end of September. So I gathered up a chunk of my points and went down to say hey to some people. And then for my big 4-0, I was in Palm Springs for Western Exposure. So Western Exposure XXL, which they have 2 weekends back to back now. So I came in on the second weekend because that was easier to book. Got to hang out with some friends, got to get up to a lot of trouble. It was a lot of fun. And then I actually have another trip down to Orlando next week for a friend's Halloween/birthday party.
Nice. Very nice. And happy belated birthday. Obviously, we wish you a happy birthday on the page. And if you listening did not get to wish BJ a happy birthday, feel free to do so in the comments. Throw up some birthday love on the Facebook page or the social medias, anywhere that you can find us. And Eric, did you do some curling traveling recently?
I did. I was in between Baltimore and D.C. at the Potomac Curling Club for the Glitter Bomb Spiel.
Oh,
it was a lot of fun. Yeah.
That is lovely. I completely forgot it was this time of year and actually mentioned it by name to a couple of Canadian bears while it was happening without even realizing it was happening. And then found out afterwards because Chris Mina, I didn't realize he was also at the Glitter Bomb Spiel. So it's that is lovely. That's always a good time. So did you enjoy yourself? How did you do?
It was a lot of fun. I got to curl with three other individual registrants. So we were a team of four people who hadn't curled together before. I got to curl with somebody that Brian knows up at Seattle, Neil.
What? Wait a minute. Nobody's told me this until now. My mind is blown. Neil is one of my, he's one of my co-conspirators for Rainbow Spiel. Yeah. And he's amazing. Isn't he a lot of great fun and energy?
Yeah, he was great fun.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's awesome. Glad you had a good time, though. I miss some of those boys that I've met up there for that that spiel. So I am glad that you went and had a good time. I am personally, I am back from a trip to San Francisco, which is part of the reason why I was in touch with Chris Mina, and was there for 10 days and still managed to not see Chris while I was in town.
Aww, boo.
So that was tough, but I missed Folsom by a week. I went up the week after Folsom, but then the second weekend I was there was a new festival called Barrison Alley, which is they take over Harrison and make a little festival, and ended up running into the guys from Stocky Photos, who I have not seen in about 8 years when they were at P House for Bear Bust, when I had them come down and do the photos from that event. And then actually just after that at TBRU, I keep forgetting that I saw them after that with the pictures with Joe and Rick from Where the Bears Are. And So I ran into them. They had come down for the event and were doing the 360 camera. So that was fun, and ran into my friend Justin, who now lives in Seattle, moved from Maine to Seattle, and is my birthday buddy, who I met at Bear Bust, and we bonded over the fact that we both have the same birthday, and Bear Bust ended up being our kind of birthday party. So he coincidentally just happened to be coming to San Francisco. I reached out to him because I saw him post about Barrison on somebody else's page or somebody else's post on Facebook, and then messaged him to say, hey, you're still coming in Chicago, right? And he's like, yeah, I'm going to be in San Francisco this weekend and Chicago next weekend. And I was like, well, guess what? We're going to be in the same city 2 weekends in a row because I am in San Francisco. So I got to spend time with a good friend of the pod, Jamie. He was generous enough to let me stay with him. Went to a concert, which I'll be talking about a little bit later. And then did Barrison, did sightseeing, and also got to spend time with Chrissy because Chrissy was out in San Francisco for the Pink concert. So my worlds collided and it made for a fantastic trip. But I just got back yesterday. I had to get up at the ass crack of dawn and got about 3 hours of sleep before having to finish packing my bags and hop a flight at 6:30 in the morning to get back here at 5 o'clock at night, which then with traffic getting home, didn't get back until like 6:15, almost 6:30 last night. So it was a long day of traveling, but I'm glad to be back and to chat here with you all about pop culture and what we want to talk about. So let's jump into our first topic. Brian, I'm going to go ahead and throw it over to you. What have you got for us?
Well, Japan towards the end was a bit of a mess and I did not feel well. So I stayed in my hotel room for almost the whole weekend. But the one thing I wanted to do for sure while I was out there is see what is quite possibly, but not guaranteed to be the last Miyazaki movie to see it in Japan. So on Monday morning, it was a national holiday in Japan called Sports Day. Very weird holiday, but whatever. And I decided I'm going to go see the movie How Do You Live? Or Kimitachi wa Do Ikuru Ka? In this U.S. and in other countries, I think they're renaming this to The Boy and the Heron. But I got to see this in the original Japanese, no subtitles. And I will just tell you right now that even though my Japanese is getting way better than it used to be, I definitely did not pick up probably about a half of what they were saying. And a lot of times in Miyazaki, you know, we've all seen Miyazaki, Studio Ghibli films. Like, you can just sit back and let the visuals and the music wash over you and you can keep up pretty well with what's going on. The problem was this movie is, it's a little obscure at times. It's a little abstract's not the right word, because it's typically pretty straightforward as far as the visuals. There are stylistic things that Miyazaki is now doing, making certain moments sketchier, so to speak. And that's to convey a sense of chaos and confusion. But there are definitely monologues and little character introductions and catch-up moments where you're like, it would really help if I knew more than a handful of Japanese words right now.
You just went expert mode. Like, you're like, I'm going to go expert mode for this movie.
I had to, though, because like Miyazaki is one of my favorite filmmakers. Japan is like my favorite country to go visit, whether it's for work or for fun. I love the idea of seeing. I mean, I was like, yeah, I've got to do it. And I knew it'd be rough. And I had heard already that this movie was sort of receiving mixed criticisms. Like, some people love it. They think it's a perfect swan song to his career. It sort of recapitulates some of the ideas that he's had in other movies. And it kind of lets him put his own take on these other works that I'll talk about in a second. But it's not everybody's cup of tea. And as a swan song, as a last work, it's bittersweet at a minimum. I would say it's at a probably more likely it's depressing. Like, it's not a good time in a lot of moments. In some moments it's fun. So it's funny, cause I was thinking like the beginning is sort of tragic. You know, this character, my God, I cannot think of his name. Maito. Maito is sort of a young boy caught up in the aftermath of World War II, and he loses his mother very tragically. This happens in the first like 5 minutes, so it's very dark and chaotic. And so the family that's left, the dad and Maito, they move to rural Japan to be with his deceased mother's sister. Basically, the dad, which is not an uncommon tradition in older bygone eras, the dad will marry, or the man will marry the younger or whatever sister, the unmarried sister of the family, to kind of keep it in the family, sort of in a weird way. It's weird to us, but you know. So he goes back and he remarries this sister, and the kid Maito is just devastated. He's miserable. He wants to sort of. He seems like he wants to be doing something with his life. Either fight the war or to just anything to get off of this, I think, sort of wallowing in this depression. And so he's having a really rough time, and he's meeting all these women who stylistically look like Yubaba from Spirited Away. I was just watching that again. And they took that same character design and like cloned her like 10 times. And there's all these little older women. Smaller than Yubaba, running around like being like the nursemaids and sort of the servants in this big household, this wealthy seeming estate. Anyway, so he's just miserable. He doesn't like his new mom. You know, his dad's, you know, like a lot of Japanese salarymen, just not there, off working in the whatever's. Actually, I think he's a lot of biographical elements poke in from Miyazaki's life. He did lose a parent in the war. I think he lost his mom as well. His dad worked as a munitions, like an industry, you know, business person, engineer, building war materials. So that's sort of coming into this. But yeah, so Maito is just miserable and sad, and he encounters this giant heron. And anyone who's lived in Florida or other coastal communities, herons are like pretty from afar. But you don't want to mess with them. They're
horrifying.
Yeah. They can be pretty intense.
Not a fan.
Yeah. What are the herons that we would get around UCF?
The sandhill cranes.
Oh, they're cranes. Okay. So similar, yeah. But yeah. So sandhill cranes, like they're tall, they're big, big birds, and they're loud, and they can swoop in on you and kind of, So, Yeah, so the Heron is kind of like that, and he's kind of harassing Maito, and eventually starts talking, and you're like, what the hell? Why is he talking? But of course, it's a Miyazaki film, so you know, you're really not that surprised if you're used to Miyazaki films. So this is sort of the prologue. This starts him into the story. From here, he basically learns that like if he goes with this Heron, he can go and he can rescue his mother. And if there's some confusion about which mother, because there's his mom that died, and then his new mother, his mother's sister, ends up like going into the woods and then just like disappearing. So they're looking for her too. And ultimately he kind of has to go on this journey to try to save her in this magical world that's sort of the land of the unborn and dying. And it's just the spiritual realm that has a lot of familiar imagery. Again, if you've seen other Miyazaki films, he definitely seems to be referencing certain things, not overt, like beat you on the head, but like, again, the Yubaba looking old women, he's got little, like, I guess they're unborn children souls that look like the, was it the, from Mononoke, the, Kumamoto, what, no, what's the little, the wood spirits, the little alien looking wood spirits.
Oh, those creepy things.
Kodomo. And it's stupid because Kodomo means kid in Japanese, and they're just the children of the sport of the forest. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So like he's got little elements like that, and like the soot balls or something that kind of looks like that. And anyway, so he's going to this magical world and he's kind of trying to work with this Heron who's very antagonistic. And oh, by the way, at this point, it's no longer just a Heron. It's a fat, bald guy with a giant nose inside the Heron. So he's like wearing the Heron is almost like a disguise, like a full body thing, but he's got Heron legs and he's running around. It's a little disturbing imagery wise.
It sounds like some sort of Oni or something.
I mean, they're kind of spirits. They're kind of, I think you're definitely right. So what stood out for me, so I don't want to go through the whole plot. I mean, hijinks ensue. He meets other characters. He has adventures, yada, yada, right? He learns something in the end. I think what stands out to me about this movie is the soundtrack. It's very minimalist. It's Joe Hisaishi. So same scorer who's done all the soundtracks for like the last long time with Miyazaki. But it's very stark and barren and just single piano notes and some minor chords. Think of like Breath of the Wild, how minimal that was. The music was just so innocuous, but it's just like not almost non-existent, but then it would come in very bold and you'd get that like restatement of the day. So like a lot of that, and that just is unsettling at times in the score, because whereas a Miyazaki film like Spirited Away or Princess Mononoke or Howl's Moving Castle or Castle in the Sky, you'd get more lush, lyrical, warm music, and this is not that. I like it. I'm not saying I don't like it. It's very different, and it sets a tone that makes this movie, again, very at times unsettling. The other thing that stands out to me, there are a lot of birds in this movie. The Heron, of course, then there's a whole fleet of pelicans that are horrifying in that they're massing and they're eating the souls of unborn children at one point, which is kind of horrifying when you realize like what it is. And then there's like parakeets and there's other types of cranes, and there's just flocks and flocks of these birds. And then they eventually kind of become a fascist, like kind of Nazi-esque army that are all birds, like bird people. It's like, I'm like, what happened to Miyazaki with birds? Like, why is he so horrified? And like, why does he need to? I think, you know, if you're a fan of birds, you may or may not enjoy this movie. They do kind of do a cool thing when the birds leave this magic land. They become like normal sized, like simple, whatever birds. And they're gorgeous and they're harmless. And it's kind of funny because there's shit all over the place. So several times when this like flock escapes through the door into the real world, it's like they just like all just swarm and sit all over the people, which is kind of hilarious. Like, you're like, wait a minute, Is that? Oh, that is all the bird droppings. Okay, that's a nice touch. Good job, Miyazaki. Very well played. But again, what birds like shat all over his house or something, and he's just like reliving this trauma for us.
This is like a really bad Batman origin story.
With these birds. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, right. I mean, Miyazaki. If you see a recent video of him, he's shaven. He's completely like clean cut now. I don't know if that's he screwed up one morning and or maybe there's a reason. I don't know. He looks completely different. So maybe he's getting into shape. He wants to have a second career as a supervillain. But yeah. So I mean, I will say this. I thoroughly enjoyed seeing this movie in Japanese and living through this experience and having this moment and it was really touching in that way. I will see this in the theaters in the US with probably an English dub and or we'll do this, probably do both at some point. They did just announce the voice cast, and I was kind of surprised by some of the choices. This came out, I think, today.
I'm always surprised about the Miyazaki English voice cast. I'm always surprised by them.
They usually do a pretty good job. So we got Christian Bale, Dave Bautista, Gemma Chan, Willem Dafoe, Aaron Fukuhara, Mark Hamill, Robert Pattinson, and Florence Pugh. So, like some names that you're like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. They're all the hotness now or whatever. But I'm interested to hear those voices, and then probably never watch the dub again and only watch the subtitles because honestly, that's always my preference with these movies. So, So when The Boy and the Heron comes out in the U.S., which should be very soon, it's been in a few film festivals already in the States. But now that the voice cast is announced, I'm guessing it'll be like a few months maybe, but I think by the end of this year. So if you're a Miyazaki fan or you just want to try something different, that's not your normal kids movie animation thing. Also, this is still hand drawn, which is very special because, you know, Disney stopped doing that years ago, right? Miyazaki, Ghibli even like largely stopped. They do mostly CG stuff now, but this is hand drawn with CG like backgrounds and stuff, and it is just gorgeous and beautiful and dark and eerie and it's a trip. You should see it. How Do You Live or The Boy and the Heron? I did say I would talk about the books. It is based on two books, not just the one called How Do You Live, but it's complicated because How Do You Live is, it shows up in the story. It's actually a book that Miyazaki's mother, I think, gave him before she died and was really influential to him. And in this movie, the mom leaves this book for her son and he reads it. And it's a book about deciding how you want to live your life from a younger person's perspective, but with the wisdom conveyed of the elders and sort of just like life stories. But the movie itself, The Boy and the Heron, is not based on that exactly. I'm trying to remember what the other one, I meant to look this both up, but there is another movie that has a similar idea. I think is it The Borrow? No, sorry, that's not it. It's basically the same idea that there's this kid and he discovers this building. The building has like a gateway into another world and he lost his mom or he loses some family member, has to go into the underworld. Kind of Orpheus-ish if you're, you know, into Greek mythology. Go into the underworld to find his loved one and bring him back. So that's what this movie is more an adaptation of. But the How Do You Live part is interesting. I kind of want to read the book now. Evidently, it's a very influential book for Miyazaki. So, yeah, I don't know. Go check it out. Let us know what you think. Especially this group here, when any of you guys end up seeing it, you'll have to let me know if I painted an accurate picture or if you were as horrified by birds as I was.
I am scared. What do you give it on a flame rating scale?
Oh, it's Miyazaki. So we'll do a 4.5 out of 5 because it's Miyazaki. I mean, it's and even okay Miyazaki is still so much better than most any other filmmaker alive or ever. So yeah, 4.5.
All right. That is a film that we have discussed. that I will probably not ever see, but I appreciate hearing about it. And that vivid description just gave me all I needed to know about it. So I should be okay from here on out. All right. Eric, let's throw it over to you. What is your topic?
Well, let's stay on the Mark Hamill train and discuss the new spooky series on Netflix, The Fall of the House of Usher, which is...
This is not about the musician Usher, right?
No, not this time. His house hasn't fallen as of yet, I believe.
Boo! Boo!
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, sorry. Okay. Back to the fall of
the wrong black person.
Wow.
That's not Usher.
Wow.
It was. I started with Usher, all right? I would like it known.
You started with Usher.
I started and with
you
Usher.
You went to Lil Jon.
Listen. Eric threw us onto that, and I had to.
Well, because they collabed on that song. It was, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
There were ties to it. Oh, sorry, Eric. Back to you.
So, The Fall of the House of Usher is an American gothic horror drama miniseries created by Mike Flanagan, the creator of the two haunting series of Hill House and Blythe Manor. And it's loosely based on the short story of the same name and other works by Edgar Allan Poe. So kind of the short synopsis is the CEO of a corrupt pharmaceutical company faces his questionable past when his children start dying in mysterious and brutal ways.
Yay, eat the rich. Oh, exactly. Now I really want to see it. I didn't know that's what it was about. Holy fuck.
Oh, I'm in. You just wait. It gets so, yeah.
Yeah. Mike Flanagan brought back a lot of previous actors from the other series that he's previously done, including Cara Gugino. Is that how you say your last name?
Oh, sure. I like that. Yeah.
Have we ever said people's names correctly on the show?
Kate Siegel. Rahul Kohli.
Again, sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's, yeah, that's how you say his name, and I want to marry him.
BJ knows how to say it because he's going to take his name.
100%. I'm going to hyphenate, but I want to make sure the hyphenated name I know how to say.
Have you seen any of the shots of him from this work, BJ?
No, I didn't. Actually, I just found out today that Tom Flanagan made this series.
You're going to Mike Flanagan. You're going to lose your mind. You're going to shoot your wad up almost immediately when you see how he looks in this. And he's a queer character. Oh my God, you got to watch it.
And a video game creator and gay. Oh, well, yeah. Maybe Pam. I mean, I don't know.
Queer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fine.
Just about everybody in this show, at least all of the children, all have, I won't say, messed up is the wrong word for it, unique sexual proclivities, I would say.
Yes, that's the same assessment. I mean, we could go
not
through
Eric trying to dance around kink shaming. He's like, I'm about to kink shame. I don't want to ick anybody's yum, shame. But... oh, God, don't. Not ick. Not
he
ick.
Doesn't want to ick anybody's yum. I get
whoa,
it.
Stop saying it. Stop.
Don't ick my yum.
Oh, please stop. That's
one of the greatest UK drag race songs ever.
What was the wrong with yuck? Don't yuck my yum. Like, that's fine. But ick?
I never even heard of someone say ick.
A phrase I've heard is it gives me the ick is one of the phrases I've heard recently.
I know that's a little bit more common. And like Chantal Roche was the first person I heard ever say, first person I've ever heard say, don't yuck my yum or I'm not going to yuck someone's yum. And then when I watched that episode, it was like my new song, don't ick my yum or whatever. I was like, that is it sounds so insanely gross. It sounds so gross. Please stop. Thank God it wasn't that great of a song anyway, so it's fine. It's no breakup, bye-bye. I'm just saying. Just going to put it out there.
It's no ding, dang, dung.
Oh. UK hum. Mm.
But I right, really
back to Eric King shaming everybody. Got it.
Exactly. No, but I really love the performances in this, especially the patriarch and matriarch of the family, Roderick and Madeline, Bruce Greenwood and Mary McDonald, both are amazing.
Did you read who the original actor that played Roderick was, and that they filmed for 2 months before they left the production because of inappropriate sexual behavior?
John Barrowman.
Was it Kevin Spacey? Was well, it?
No, it's Frank Lang. Dumb game. Frank Langella. Oh, okay. But can you imagine anybody else besides Bruce Greenwood playing this role now? He is so perfect and walks this line between like horrible, Trumpy, pharma bro, but older, like, person. But also somewhat sympathetic. Like, I, at moments, absolutely was rooting for him against all odds and all, like, reason. Because, like, I mean...
Present day or past? Present day or past Roderick?
I think it's both. But I honestly, a present day. Because, like, past, he's a little ineffectual. He's a little, like, kind of all over the place. And, you know, the current one, you can just... Like just a tribute to the actor and the writing. Honestly, this production is amazing. I like Mike Flanagan's stuff. I think Midnight Mass is my favorite of his things.
Yes.
More so than the other ones, but this might be now my favorite because it's just so densely well layered and put together and interlocking. And there's like a tribute to Poe. I don't think there's anything else that in mainstream culture is so comprehensive and like loving and yet also very modern and a satirical or not satirical, but like a social commentary on medicine and healthcare and, you know, capitalism. I mean, anyway, but yeah, Greenwood is an amazing actor in general. This is the best role he's ever played. I think he should get Emmys and whatever's for days because he goes through it as a character. Roderick Usher goes through it and he conveys all of those different emotions. So anyway, sorry. I have a lot to say about this and I will not.
No, that's fine. I didn't realize that it was going to cover all of Poe's works. I thought it was mainly going to just stick with the Fall of House of Usher, but it goes all over the place. And kind of as evidenced by the individual episode titles, which are just, they're all named after his different short stories. And a lot that I had not read or heard of before.
I think I'm familiar with it.
I'm only familiar with three.
Which three? I'll tell you. We'll tell you if they're in there.
Obviously it was at the Raven.
Yeah.
The Pit and the Pendulum.
Yep.
Honestly, I don't think you could name anything that's like mainstream Poe that's not in there in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So I mean, the framing narrative is the House of Usher, right? That is the framing story. That's the whole arc of the story, right? But the interlocking pieces inside of it are like little vignette. They're almost episodic, but they're meant to be because they're individual like kids. From the House of Usher, they're individual of the children. Those are the ones where, like, the one you really like, and I also like Raoul Coley. His character is part of a black cat story illusion. Basically, if you're familiar with the black cat, it involves this, you know, person killing a cat, and then the cat comes back to life and haunts them, and you know, hijinks ensue, right? So that's his arc, his sort of you know, main episode. I don't want to spoil too many of them, but like Telltale Heart's there in a pretty cool and modern way. Pin the Pendulum, we mentioned. That one's That one's interesting. They actually use that in a couple little places. They actually have like the old, was it Hammer that did the Pit and the Pendulum movie in like the 40s? They have that earlier on, and yeah. then they have probably one of my favorite actors in it, only because it's so weird seeing him older, is the actor who played Elliot in E.T., Henry Thomas, who's Broderick, they call him. Basically the oldest son, who kind of is like a wannabe of his dad. So he has a little element of Pit and the Pendulum. The first one, holy fucking shit.
Like, that was the first, insane.
I think we will spoil this. Because it's in the promo. There is a shot of Carl Gugino, who's actually also an amazing actress in this piece, because she's playing the same character, but she's playing different manifestations of the same character, so to speak. And the one that is not the first one you meet, but the one that's probably most iconic for Poe fans, is the Mask of the Red Death. And basically the incarnation of death herself coming to this bacchanal during the plague, in the Middle Ages plague period. I forgot now if it's Middle Ages or not, but you get what I'm saying. So this is a modern version of, not if we had a plague, but what would be similar, in that you have a party where people meet their unfortunate end. And it is horrifyingly disgusting and just so unsettling. And then it's like the first full story. I think there's like a little bit of a starting point.
It's the second episode, but yeah.
But it's that first full Poe homage episode that you're like, okay, we're doing this now. And again, if you know Poe, it's really cool to see it interlocking and how it comes up. If you don't know Poe, it's fine. You don't need to. I think it adds another layer of context, and it may spoil certain things if they, they don't always stick. They absolutely do not stick, like, literally to every story. However, they do pretty close to a lot of them, and they modernize certain things, but still use some of the old Poe language, like the Ode to Annabel Lee or whatever that poem is. Like, that is like almost the whole thing is in there somewhere, bits and pieces. The Raven, of course, is a big part of the last episode. Every character gets some really cool moments, and like just a cast, like you, Eric, like you talked about. I mean, freaking Mark Hamill. Like, when's the last time we've seen Mark Hamill not just doing voiceover work and having such a great, like, weird little character that he gets to like have fun with, but not like, it's a very muted, underscored Mark.
It's definitely not a fun character.
But what a force of nature, right? Mary McDonnell as Madeline Usher. Yeah. Oh my God. I love Mary. I'm a Battlestar Galactica for days, right? I love that show. In fact, she's not the only one from Battlestar in this. The guy who plays the CEO of Fortunato, which is another Poe reference, but it's also the pharmaceutical company that the Ushers are basically in control of. The old CEO is played by a guy from, I think his name is Anders from Battlestar, Michael Truoco.
Yeah.
I couldn't place it. I was like, I know him. What is he from? And then I'm like, oh my God, he's another Battlestar guy. Carl Lumley. Carl Lumley from Mantis from Battlestar. I think he also showed up in one episode. He, great TV actor, done a lot of stuff. He's Augustin Dupont, which, again, if you're a Poe fan, the Duke Morgue, the murders at the Dude Morgue, the, you never say this right. At the Rue Morgue. Okay, I'm sorry. So there is an erotica that my boyfriend wrote that is a Poe pastiche that is called Murders at the Dude Morgue. It's better than the title, right? The title's dumb. But I can't not think of that. Because, again, his first – this is partly why I think I've become such a Poe nut. He also wrote a House of Usher tribute thing, and it's called House of Otter. Anyway, but just seeing all these different cool – mostly television actors. I don't know if you realize that, or if it was something you noticed. Like, these are a lot of just different character actors from television, and they're all in such nice and crazy and interesting roles that, anyway, I'm going to stop talking because I could just, But Eric, what was your favorite? Well, if you had to pick one of the little vignettes? Is there one that stands out to you that's your favorite?
Probably Victorine's, because I just love that Poe story.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we can tell people it's.
I mean, it's the telltale heart, but yeah,
she's a heart researcher. I mean, it's pretty much it's like okay, yeah, that's gonna be the one. So like, she's amazing.
And I mean, when they showed the fake out of her at first, like, I mean, I knew what had happened, but I didn't know what had happened because that reveal was crazy.
Yeah.
And I still haven't watched the last episode. I've watched 7 of the 8 episodes. So.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So just, there's really no way to prepare you. The only thing I will say, this is just a criticism, I guess. Once you've gone 7, like the 8th is almost all denouement. It's not like there's revelations, but they're not revelations that you didn't see telegraphed coming a mile away. Like,
yeah,
they basically lay it all out. Like, there's an underlying reason all this shit's happening, and you get that fully portrayed. And it,
yeah, I mean, you kind of understand throughout. Yeah. Okay, this is kind of where this is going. So, I mean, I can't imagine it's too surprising. But
there is a couple scenes towards the end that you're like, oh my God, about. But like, if you've read The House of Usher, if you remember certain things from that story, like those click into place. And let me know when you finish it, because it's a ride. We watched it last night, and I'm glad I finished it, because I was worried I was not like spoiled, because I mean there's certain things like you're not gonna get spoiled really, but there were certain things that I'm glad I didn't find out otherwise, you know. So yeah, good stuff. Halloween adjacent. I don't think of Poe necessarily as like Halloween, but I mean, I get the spooky similarity kind of overlap.
It's just macabre. That's all.
Yes. Very much in that macabre spirit. I would say do a episode a night and just sprinkle it out throughout the week or weekend or whatever, and just have your little gem of the macabre. And 8 episodes. His last big project for Netflix, which is sad, but also I think he probably kind of realized that there's other places for him to tell his stories. And guy's smart, so smart, such a great writer. So there's some monologues he writes in this series that are not Poe. They're very much Mike Flanagan, but they are great. And I kind of want to learn one of them because it's so perfect. It's the one that Roderick talks about with the lemons.
Oh like my gosh. I was like, as that was going on, I'm like, this is brilliant. This will get the Emmy for Bruce for sure.
It's such a brilliant deconstruction of the modern capitalist system. And it's based around the ideas, what do you do when life gives you lemonades? And of course, it's like, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. Of course, that's the obvious aphorism, but that's not what he says. He's like, absolutely no, that's wrong, and goes through this whole thing. There's one more monologue that Mary McDonnell gets in the last episode. It's almost as brilliant. It's so good. So look forward to that too. I don't know. Fall of House of Usher has been probably one of the best things I've seen in a while. So yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
It makes me want to go back and finally watch Midnight Mass, because I haven't watched it yet.
Yes. Oh, it's fantastic. It is absolutely fantastic, and I would say that is definitely a good one to watch during spooky season. It is really good.
You get the brother from New Christine, which Pat, I know you were a fan of. Like, you get that brother in this amazingly messed up role as this vampire priest guy. It's good. It's a good series. And then the what's her name? Tamerlane, the actress who plays her. She's the main like the church person
Zach Guilford, who played young Roderick, is also in Midnight Mass.
Yeah, I forgot about him.
I knew him from Friday Night Lights. That's where I knew him from, because he was one of the main characters in that. But
Yeah, no, it's a great show. Yeah, BJ, Pat, you got to watch it at some point. It's really, really good.
We'll see. I haven't watched any of the other ones, so.
Oh my goodness! Both of the Haunting series are good, great, fantastic.
I've not watched either of them. I have friends that have, and obviously many of you guys have, but it hasn't been something that has been high on my list, and that list is ridiculously fucking long at this point. But we'll see. This is one of those things where you don't have to watch the other ones to enjoy. Like these anthology based or
all standalone,
anthology-esque. Yeah, standalones. There you go. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, that is The Fall of the House of Usher on Netflix. Go check it out. Let the boys know what you think. And we thank you all for listening in, for enjoying our podcast, and being here to just keep us going, doing what we're doing. You can check out our website at flameonshow.com. There you can find all of our socials, how you can email us, get in touch with us. All of the links are there. Also, just linktree.com/flameonshow. You get all of our links there. And we just appreciate you tuning in and listening to our show. So go check us out online, flameonshow.com, and maybe even cop a little Flame On swag from our shop link on the website. All right, real quick before I have BJ do our last topic, I'm not really going to do a full topic. Had a lot going on, and with travel and everything, I have a bunch of little things and just felt kind of weird about focusing on anything or trying to expand on anything, make it into something that was a major topic. But I do want to touch on, I mentioned that I went to San Fran. My trip to San Fran was based around a concert, and then it turned into a 10-day trip, which was fantastic. But I went to see Death Cab for Cutie and the Postal Service. I think I may have mentioned it. It may have been a one-up when it was announced. It may have just been in the group chat. I don't remember. Time is an odd construct, and I don't remember things because I'm getting old. All right, fine. I am old. Now, we've gotten past the getting. We are just there. But it is a kind of milestone event and something that I wanted to mention because this tour is celebrating the 20th anniversary of Death Cab for Cutie's kind of their breakout album, Transatlanticism, which I believe was their fourth album, and the Postal Service's only album, Give Up. And the kind of fun part about this is not only is it 20 years, but essentially after they toured in celebration of the 10-year anniversary of Give Up, they said that they were disbanding and they were not reuniting, and that was the end of the Postal Service. So Ben Gibbard, who is the lead singer and instrumentist, part of Death Cab for Cutie, is lead vocals for Postal Service. It is a side project, kind of indie supergroup. The Wikipedia says that it's an American indie pop supergroup from Seattle, Washington, but that's really only Ben Gibbard. I know that Death Cab is born out of the Pacific Northwest. And then Jimmy Tamborello, who is also known as Dental. And I keep forgetting that he's also James Figurine, which doesn't really mean a lot to most people. But there is one song that takes me back years and years and years. It's 555-666-88833. And for those old people out there in the room and listening, those of us who T9 texts or have done T9 texting in the past, that actually means something to us. Kids nowadays won't know what that means. So it doesn't have the same resonating factor. After they did their tour in 2013, they also released a documentary and pretty much said that this is it. Postal Service, no longer gonna tour and not gonna do anything. And cut to 10 years later, and they announced that the band would reunite. So not only is it Ben Gibbard, but Jimmy Tamborello and Jenny Lewis. So Jenny Lewis being backing vocals on a number of the tracks on the album. So the three of them, full tour, and I got to see them in Berkeley at the Greek. So it was a phenomenal show. I cried more than I ever thought I would. They literally did transatlanticism from beginning to end. So Ben Gibbard opened for Ben Gibbard. Death Cab was up first. They did transatlanticism, and then Postal Service closed the show, did All of Give Up, and then did two encore tracks, including the Iron and Wine version of Such Great Heights with Ben Gibbard on like acoustic ukulele, I think, and Jenny Lewis doing the accompanying vocals there, and then brought everybody out to do a cover of Depeche Mode's Enjoy the Silence. But they also brought out Jenny Wood, who was the only real like duet on Give Up. Clark Gable, or no, sorry, Nothing Better. Nothing Better. She came out, they brought her out for that. So it was phenomenal. Got to hear all of the actual vocals, all of the, like, everything from the album is great. And literally just lost it when Ben Gibbard said, ladies, gentlemen, and theys, this is Give Up. And I just lost it. It was phenomenal. But it was a great reason to go visit San Francisco for the first time and an amazing concert experience. So that, I just wanted to bring it up and mention that. But yeah, so let's move on to our, and I mean, I talk about it now, but the tour is over. So it's not even like I could say, hey, if they're coming to a city near you, go see them. but if you've never listened to Give Up, go listen to it. There's also a 10th anniversary deluxe edition that's got unreleased stuff and remixes and all that. So Postal Service, Give Up. Go listen to it. BJ, close us out with your topic. What have you got for us?
So in line with spooky season, I watched all of Castlevania Nocturne on Netflix, which is a standalone sequel series to the Castlevania animated series. So I know there's a lot of weirdness with the animated series and like how the timeline works, what games they're doing. Castlevania, the original series, mostly adapted Castlevania 3 video game as a series. This one adapts Castlevania Rondo of Blood, which was released in 1993, and its sequel Symphony of the Night, which was released in 1997, as well as story elements from Harmony of Dissonance. So it combines three games into one series. The references are everywhere if you're familiar with the Castlevania series. But this one is set in 1792 during the French Revolution. So, and it follows Richter of Belmont and Maria Renard, which were two playable characters, I believe, in Symphony of the Night. So it's really, it's absolutely fucking gorgeous. It's been a while since I've seen an animated series that made my mouth drop with just how fucking gorgeous it is. The music is stunning. The cast is all kind of weird. They're kind of all over the place. Cause I know, you've got, Pixie Davies, who was Annabelle and one of the kids in Mary Poppins Returns. She was in the sci-fi series Humans, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. She's kind of flip-flopped everywhere. She was apparently in, what was that? She was Secret of Crickley Hall. So she's kind of like up and coming. She's younger. She's like really young too. So she's kind of in there. And then playing Richter Belmont is Edward Blumel. Blumel. And I know he was in Killing Eve and A Discovery of Witches. But a lot of everything else he's done has mostly just been like dramas. He was in Sex Education for 6 episodes. I wouldn't say this is his breakout role, but it kind of feels like it's his breakout role. And he also had a video game role. He was in the Dark Pictures, The Devil in Me, which are those horror video games where if you make a decision, somebody could die, or you can make a decision where somebody could live. He's really good. The core cast is fantastic. I love all their voice work. Everybody else is like there's some well-known people, but not like super well-known. Like you would have to actually be looking for like voice actors in general, which I kind of like. So it's not just like big names. It's people like actually in the voice acting industry. And then holy fucking shit, the diversity. You've got a side story with Annette, who is kind of like a she can manipulate metal is kind of her thing. And her story takes place in actually the Caribbean on a slave sugar plantation where she was a slave underneath a vampire plantation owner. So you've got the whole thing is kind of as a reference to how the upper class, especially in French, 1792 France, the upper class takes advantage of the lower class, which is a huge theme that works for today. But you also have the fact that you have vampires that like to ingratiate themselves to the upper class so they can kind of operate with impunity. So you've got that layer. You've got the idea that you've got a man of the cloth who is more concerned with defending the church than the people. Because during the French Revolution, a lot of churches got toppled because a lot of churches supported the status quo, the marquee sort of thing. So you've got that whole, you've got the whole idea of slaves and masters, and there's so many layers to it. You have an Aztec vampire named Olrox, who is a major antagonist in the show, but at the same time, he is also very much like, I've heard this song and dance before. It didn't work out well for my people. So you've got, it's the way they interweave the theme of like, what makes a slave, what makes a master, is that the default of all societies, or like of people in general, or can we rise above to be something more? And especially Maria, who's kind of a fledgling revolutionary, it's really refreshing to have all these themes front and center, and it's the main focus, but it's not the main focus. Like you have individual character development for Richter, for Annette, even a little bit for one of the antagonists, Drolta. So it's good. And like I said, the melanin is everywhere. There's a lot of melanin in this season, and that makes me exceptionally happy. So yeah, the diversity of the cast, the diversity of the characters in general, it's really, really nice. And for those of you listening that are like, where's Trevor Belmont and everybody in Sypha? This takes place 300 years after the last Castlevania series. They mention in reference to Sypha, and they mention like the Belmont family crest and all that stuff. But other than that, this is very much a standalone series. So you can actually start with this series and then go back and watch the other Castlevania if you really want to get to know what's going on. Have any of you guys watched it at all?
No, I haven't watched since maybe second season of Castlevania. I
really want to watch it, but I'm kind of dismayed that, and I don't know if this was a mutual thing, but Warren Ellis was a big part of why I enjoyed the first, was it three or four seasons of that story? And I guess the new series is not by him. So I don't know. His writing's still pretty good. The dialogue's still pretty funny and witty.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, actually, it's hilarious because you have Richter, who is very much a Belmont, but then you have I will say this one pushes a little bit more of the dramedy because Drolta is absolutely fucking hilarious. Like she doesn't give a fuck. Olrox is a very compelling character. Olrox is exceptionally compelling. You've got the priest is actually really, the priest is kind of like the tortured character of the season, but Richter and Annette's chemistry is really good. There's the music though, the music and the art in this season are just jaw dropping. It's really good. So it's really cute. It definitely feels a little bit like the first season of the original Castlevania, where they were still trying to kind of figure out figure out kind of the pacing, not really the pacing, but kind of the, like, there's a lot more funnier moments sprinkled around Castlevania after season one. This one, it feels like they kind of want to do that, but they also kind of want to keep with it. It's a very French series. Like watch this, and I dare you to not immediately want to go to a French cafe and get some like fresh baked bread or something. It's very French, but honestly, the villains, there's one or two where you're like, yeah, absolutely kill him. But then like Drolta is probably my favorite. She's the one that kind of has the, I believe she was actually a boss in Symphony of the Night as a succubus. Her aesthetic and the way she talks and everything, it's really funny. Like, you really end up liking her a lot. You don't really root for her, but you're definitely, you're like, please stay on the screen a little bit longer. So, and there's a bit more queer, there's some queer storytelling in there too. So yeah, the diversity is everywhere. I definitely would say it's 8 episodes. I believe it's 27 minutes, 30 minutes an episode. It's definitely worth a watch. They got me from the get-go. The opening was really good. So, yeah, no, if you haven't watched it, it's kind of the perfect easy watch for spooky season.
Nice. It's funny because you say that, like, you know, people are coming there looking for Trevor and all that. I'm like, you have not played the original games then, because they do not overlap. They are separate stories completely. Which I think I might have first played Castlevania with Richter and then went back and had some Trevor adventures. But yeah, I've heard some good things about it. I may have to go back and watch it again. Long list of things that I have not watched, because when I find myself at a point where I'm like, okay, let me sit down, I also know that I will probably be asleep in half an hour. So I just put on my YouTube videos and I just watch those and then wake up 3 hours later, asleep on my couch at 2 a.m. to some random video playing. And I then shut off my TV and go to bed. Yeah, Castlevania Nocturne on Netflix now. So go check it out and let BJ know what you think online on the interwebs, wherever you like to leave your comments, maybe on X, the website formerly known as Twitter. I hate when people say that so badly. Like, either just keep calling it Twitter or just call it X and leave it be. Like, I don't need this formerly known as. Anywho, that's another conversation for another time. Although, can I just tell you, I forgot that the Twitter headquarters is in San Fran. And I just happened to be, I was at the Lone Star trying to get a lift back to Jamie's house. And it wasn't that far from where the bar was. And I saw it on the map, like looking for Lyft cars. And then the next day we were taking a lift to the ferry building. So I could see the iconic Port of San Francisco sign or lettering. And I mentioned it to Jamie and our Lyft or Uber driver, forget what, which one, our driver, was like, oh yeah, it's across the street from my house. He's like, when the 3 or 4 days when they had that giant flashing X up, it was not a good time. And I was like, oh, that is kind of crazy that I mentioned in the car, and it's somebody who lived right there and dealt with the flashing X. Ridiculous. All right, well, that is our topics. We thank you again for listening and supporting our podcast, continuing to keep us going by hearing your feedback, your comments, engaging with you all online. So we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, post on our Facebook page, send us messages. We'd love to hear from you and keep on listening. And before we wrap up for this episode, we're going to do a round of one-ups. So let's go back the way that we came. And Brian, why don't you let us know what your one-up is for the month of October?
So I just got this when I was in Japan. It came in the mail and I got it and opened up as soon as I got home. Friend of the show, good friend of several of us, Cena Grace, formerly of Marvel and DC. Still with DC. Self-obsessed. Being one of his best autobiographical comics. And, oh God, what was the one he did with Freeman that we met him that had the bear? Oh man, it was an Image comic. Beat the Orphanage.
Burn the Orphanage.
Burn the Orphanage. That's probably a little safer. I don't know if you want to beat. I don't want to do either one, but yes. Burn the Orphanage. Yes, sir. Anyway, he did Iceman with Marvel and a bunch of other good stuff. His new book is out, and it is a Superman YA comic that he not only wrote, but he illustrated as well. It is called Superman, The Harvests of Youth. It is from Simon and Schuster. Sorry, Simon. Is it Simon Schuster? No, sorry. Penguin Random House. Man, I can't keep anything straight today. Penguin Random House, but it is a YA graphic novel, and it is about Superman in high school, learning about life, his powers, with great whatever comes great responsibility, yada, yada, yada. But it is very, it's beautiful. This is Cena's best work. I mean, all of his stuff is great, but like he really upped his storytelling and illustrator prowess for this series. It's so just gorgeous. It deals with some dark shit, like Superman as, you know, Hal or Kent Clark. Oh my God. He actually has to confront, he's got a lot of names. He has to confront some really dark stuff in his high school and one of his classmates killing himself basically and has to sort of wrestle with this, you know, real topic that kids and adults have to wrestle with is what do you do when someone, you know, is gone and they killed themselves? Like, how do you handle that grief? How do you process it? You know, do you go down the path of, well, why could have stopped it if I was a better friend and da 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 da. So like not something Superman typically has to deal with. A lot of times in the graph in the comics, he's dealing with aliens and bad guys and terrible, crazy stuff. This is a lot more personal, and it's really touching. And all the scenes, especially his autobio stuff, is so really rich and has such depth of like life and just dealing with life. I'm glad he was able to channel that energy into a book about Superman. It really shows, and it really is a nice little thing to give to any comics fan or any non-comics fan. They just have to know who Superman is, really. And it's just great. So Superman Harvests of Youth. I know he's trying to do a little bit of a book tour, kind of getting around. He was just out actually in Palm Springs, possibly for the event you were at, BJ.
No, I didn't see
it. Yeah, he posted a picture at the Trixie Motel, and I was like, hey, wait a minute. There was a bear event. He likes the bears. This makes sense.
There were
sense.
Two, actually, that there that weekend.
Oh, well, there you go. It could have been either one. I don't know. Actually, he may have been the one that the another friend of the show, A-Stad, Cody, I think he was at, it's called Sirs or Mr. I don't know. Some, like, conference-y thing that was going on there, too. Either way, Cena's getting around, so to speak, and you should check him out if he comes to your town and go say hi and tell him that your favorite podcast, Flame On, was talking him up because yeah, we love his work and I'm excited. He's supposed to come to Seattle here soon, so I'm very excited to see him again. And yeah, go read his book, Harvests of Youth, from Random Penguin Random House.
Yeah. You said tell him your favorite podcast was talking about him, and all I thought was, why is I going to tell him some other podcast was talking about him? Tell him we were.
I just do what I do when I want other people to listen, is I just lie and tell them we were talking shit about them, and then they listen to a couple of episodes because they're worried I was talking shit about them.
Well, then we just start talking shit about them. I mean,
let's
not lie.
Listen,
let's just do it.
I am not above doing what these YouTubers are doing now and reviewing cockpits, rooms. I don't know. What else are these people reviewing? If you have any of the above and you would like us to review your thing,
if you have I'm a cockpit or a room, those are the two things that you mentioned?
That's what I've seen people reviewing. I mean, admittedly, the cockpits are reviewed on Twitter, X, whatever, OnlyFans. But the YouTubers are reviewing like people's rooms. I may have seen a dick review on there too. I don't know. I don't know how that escapes the algorithm.
Go to Blueski. There's a lot of porn over there. And
Okay, I gotta check the blue
screen. Oh yeah, there's a lot. I have a code if any of y'all need a code.
I think we all got, girl, I
hooked y'all up with codes. And I have two more codes. If anybody listening needs one, just hit me up and I can pass out some codes there. But yes, you just gotta go in and change your settings to allow sensitive material. And then the dicks just come flopping out to your feet and on the blue skis. But yeah. But no, that's awesome. I've seen a posting about his Superman book. So I'm glad that is out. I'm glad that it is phenomenal. And great job, Cena. Hey, Rick, what you got for us as far as one-ups go?
So I saw a trailer for a movie coming out called American Fiction, which is based on the book Erasure by Percival Everett. And this is a movie about an author played by Jeffrey Wright, whose books have not been doing too well. And so his agent convinces him to write a more black book using quote unquote black voice, be more urban with it. So he creates this whole new character and gets wrapped up in trying to sell himself as this completely, I don't know, more urban type person than he actually is. And I wouldn't say it's full on comedy, but it reminds me a little of, I never saw the movie. I just saw the trailers for it, but Sorry to Disturb You. Was that it? The movie
Sorry for Bothering You, I think it is.
Yeah, Sorry for Bothering You.
Yeah, Sorry for Bothering You.
Yeah, it reminds me of that in a way. But it looks really funny. It's got like I said, Jeffrey Wright playing the main character, but also Tracy Ellis Ross, Issa Rae, Sterling K. Brown, Adam Brody. Just a lot of good actors in it. So,
I mean, you sold me with Issa Rae. So, I mean,
yeah,
that right there is worth it.
Right there. That's all you had to say.
Very nice. All right. BJ, what is your one up?
So my one up, so as Brian was saying, in Palm Springs, there was a couple things going on. I did get to go swing by the Trixie Motel and pick up a couple souvenirs for my podcast, my podcast brethren. So that was an awesome experience. Shout out to Laura, who was actually inviting people to, like, you know, take some pictures and order a drink from the lobby. And the millennials in front of me just took quick pictures and then left. So I was like, daddy's going to get a drink. So really, really amazing place. If you are in Palm Springs, please go by there when their gift shop opens at 11. They usually have trouble restocking things because they never know when stuff's going to get restocked. So I got a lot of last minute items that may or may not be gone forever. I got to see the Trixie Motel and it was great. It was just a fun little, I think they had two rooms were, vacant and the rest were actually occupied. And a lot of people were hanging out by the pool and just having a grand old time. There are no TVs in the rooms. They have all of Trixie's albums on vinyl, for the record players in the room. So I thought that was really cute.
I was going to say me too, but then realized I don't have all of them.
Yeah. So we thought they were on, somebody asked if they were on sale. They do not sell the vinyl, at the hotel. So yeah, it was really, really fun. I'll definitely be swinging by again. I'm sure there's other items that'll pop up to purchase later on. I actually almost got a makeup palette set for my Halloween costume, but they didn't have the one I was looking for. So yeah,
Which one were you trying to get?
I think she had one that was it was pretty much every shade of pink you could think of. I can't remember the name of it.
Trixie putting out a pink palette?
This one was absurd. This one was probably like absurdly pink because I think it was nothing but shades of pink. I just can't remember what it was called. It's gonna drive me crazy because I don't pay enough attention to makeup. I only pay attention to makeup when I need it, which I feel most women in my life would probably have the same outlook. I only pay attention when I need it. But it was a great experience. If you're in Palm Springs, please, please, please go do it. And other than that, honorable mention, I'm looking forward to Spider-Man 2 coming out this Friday for PS5. So, yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. And that's awesome. I am excited to see what comes of Trixie Motel Season 2 as well. Because I will never stay at the Trixie Motel because that shit is expensive per night. So if I get to
Palm Springs. Are they doing a Season 2?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what the fuck it's going to be about. I mean, unless they're renovating a second motel. But
I honestly, there's a few.
She's franchising.
I mean, there's that, but then there's also one of the things that they, so when you do go there and if they do let you like go into the lobby or let you go out to the pool to take pictures, one of the things she said is don't get the housekeeping carts in the photos because they don't have them themed. So there's little bits and pieces of the place that aren't like, and I told her, I was like, oh, she's like, you might think that's weird. And I was like, I used to work for Disney. I completely understand. So like, yeah, it's branding. It's all about branding. And she was like,
break the magic.
She was like, I wish Trixie was here to hear you say that because most people are very confused when I tell them that. And I was like, nope, I fully understand. So there might be some fine tuning. I could see them doing some fine tuning or it's in a neighborhood. I don't know what's next. I didn't look to see what's next door. Maybe she could buy the house next door and expand the hotel into it. Because it is small. It is 100% a small little kitschy motel, like California to the max. But I'm interested in watching that then. I didn't think they would get to do a season two.
Yeah, there's nothing really known about it, but it has been greenlit for a second season. So we shall see. But now that makes two of the cast that's been to the Trixie Motel. Eric, you haven't made it there yet, right?
No, never been to Palm Springs.
Me either. But one day, I have a place to stay there. That's all I know. I was told there. I have a room waiting for me if I want to come out and visit. So, gonna have to do that sooner rather than later for sure. And actually, that'll tie in a little bit to my one up. I'm actually gonna mention two things: a big gay hairy hit, the Where the Bears Are documentary. Is doing the film festival circuit. So Rick Kopp, one of the stars of and writers of Where the Bears Are, was here in Chicago a couple of weeks ago. I got to go with him to see the film here in Chicago. We did a little Q&A afterwards. It was a lovely film. I got oddly sentimental and emotional over a silly web series, but seeing the people that I've become friends with, and actually seeing some of my friends featured in this documentary, because there was some stuff that was that referenced where the Bear City and showed scenes from that. And what was the other web series? It featured a Latin. It was around more of like a Latin bears adventure.
Oh, like there's the one. There's one Bulk. I know. Bulk.
Yes. So they talked to the guy that was behind Bulk, and apparently one of my friends was in that series because they showed clips from that, and he was in it. And I was like, "Oh, Josh, former Flame On host was in. They showed some of the scenes that he was in when he went out and filmed Where the Bears Are. So seeing all these people, I was like, oh, it was a cute little trip down memory lane, if you will. So if you have a chance to see it when it is at a film festival near you, or when it streams eventually, I'm sure that they're going to find a streaming outlet for this film. Check it out. Watch it. If you've seen any of Where the Bears Are, it's a great little behind the scenes. I'll be honest. I haven't finished the series. I watch parts of it, and then I would just kind of, I would get caught up with everything. Usually they would release episodes, or like the season would be like halfway through around this time, and I would be doing Bear Bust. So it kind of always just got swept away with everything else going on. And then the other thing that I want to mention is the Terror Vault. Peaches Christ's Productions, themed haunted horror experience. So now, mind you, you all know, and most of the people listening know, that I do not really do scary things. I don't really do haunted things. I don't do horror. I will say that I think I've only ever been in one haunted house, and that was probably in my teens on Long Island. I never did Halloween Horror Nights. I never did any of these things. So when I was talking to Jamie about planning this trip out to San Fran, he said, hey, would you want to go to the Terror Vault? My initial reaction was, no, I do not want to go to this because I don't want to be scared. But because it's Peaches Christ and my one time going to San Francisco, I don't know when I will be back again. I said yes, because I want to experience this. I want to be able to say that I went to Peaches Christ's Terror Vault. And it was at the Mint, the former, it was like the former Mint building. It is huge. Like, we were up and down stairs. Like, we went up at least 3 flights of stairs and then back down 3 flights of stairs all around the fucking building. We had an earlier time, like in the night, so it wasn't as busy when we got there. When we exited, because it's almost an hour that you're kind of navigating through this this entire thing. And when we got done with it, so it was almost like 8:30 when we were finishing, like the dance area was packed. There were a lot more people. It was a lot more hopping than when we first got there. But it has a whole, apparently this is like the most themed cohesive story, like an actual full fledged story. I guess it's been more like piecemeal kind of horror bits and pieces as you go through it in the past. But this was an entire, it's called The Initiation, and it's this whole storyline of you're going to, it really reminded me of, if you've watched the Dirty Computer Emotion Picture, how like you get reprogrammed and like you kind of, it's essentially a cult. And you're kind of, you start by being sat down for like the introduction video and like you're told how these people found the light. So essentially it's Scientology, because the founder's wife has gone missing and nobody has seen her. So yeah, it's this whole thing. And you get kind of bombarded by a rebel that is like, okay, now you're, you know, glad you're here and working undercover with us. And it takes you on this whole thing. And it was a very interesting experience. You can get the necklaces, like the little light up necklaces, that if you're wearing them, it allows the actors to touch you during the course of the event. Jamie bought necklaces for all of us. Only he and Barry wore their necklaces. Matt and I both did not. Matt did not even take one. I was like, maybe. And then I just put it in my pocket and was like, we'll see how
you shitted it.
No, it was good enough. They fucked with me enough, because since they couldn't touch me, there were a couple of spots where there's like the panels that drop, and they do little like jump scares. So because I wasn't wearing a necklace, those were the ones that I got targeted for. So there were a couple of those kind of experiences through the whole thing. But no, it was fantastic. If you are in San Fran during the time that these things run, go check out the Terror Vault. And we missed Jinx and Dayla by one night. They went on Friday. We went on Saturday. So, because as I got on the plane to fly to San Fran, I saw Peach's post that there was an iconic drag duo coming to the Terror Vault that evening. And she was like, and here's a list of people it is not. It was like Trixie and Katya, Bob and Monet, Willem in Alaska, Lady Bunny and her gerbil. Like, it was like, oh. So we pretty much assumed that it was going to be Jinx and Dayla. But she didn't want to post it because she didn't want, you know, to surprise the actors. But then the next day I saw the photo of them and we're just like, damn it. If only we had known and flown in earlier. But it was phenomenal. It was great. So if you have the opportunity to go see it, go do it. If you do not get to do it this year, Peaches brings it back annually. So go check it out when you have a chance. For somebody who does not like horror, I give it my seal of approval. So that is my one up, taking years off my life from being jump scared at the Terror Vault. And with that, we wrap up our October episode. My last one, narrating it as a early 40 something, before the birthday rolls around. So, the other half of our October birthdays is about to happen, and I'm excited about it. So thank you all for a phenomenal another year of podcasting and listening. And not that the podcast birthday was already earlier in the year, but for me, I'm saying that. So with that being said, go check out our website, flameonshow.com. All of our links are there, or just do the Linktree thing with Flame on Show. And check us out. Let us know what you think about the things that we talked about. Let us know what you'd like to hear us chat about. And I'll say this because I didn't really have a topic this month. I will go on record right now and say that our next micro will be a drag micro. I know there are a few people out there that'll be excited about that. Focusing on UK season 5. Because I feel like we should talk about the fact that they had a queen that they were able to completely... almost entirely.
I was going to say, completely.
Almost completely.
I spy with my little eye.
I sat there and said, wait, which one is it in the background? I was like, wait, hold on. That's how little I've been paying attention to it, but at the same time watching the episodes. But when they're going, there she is. That's who it is. And then she was gone. And just like that. But anywho, thank you all. Thank you, boys, for the chat. And for those of you listening, thank you so much for being very amazing supporters of the podcast. We couldn't do this without you. So until next time, bye, bitch.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone.